Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. When crisis hits and the impossible becomes urgent, who do you call? This week on Ira's Everything Bagel, we dive into a real-life high-stakes rescue that sounds like a Hollywood thriller, but it's all true. Author Kevin Hazard takes us inside the frantic behind-the-scenes mission during the 2014 Ebola outbreak, where a small, unconventional aviation company became the world's last hope. His book, No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to When There's Nowhere Else to Turn, reveals the daring decisions, moral risks, and rogue heroes who stepped in when no one else would. No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to When There's No One Else to Turn, published by Grand Central Publishing, is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Kevin, you go to kevinhazard.com, and you can follow him on Facebook and Instagram. And Kevin, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here, Ira.
Thanks. This is not your first book. You seem to have a passion for paramedics, which we'll get into in a little while as well, given your background. But what first drew you to this story?
I was fascinated by, you know, the things that scare us. Like, I'm one of those people, I like scary movies. You know, I'm kind of drawn to things that scare you, you know?
I'm the opposite. I don't want to see anything.
Yeah, I don't blame you. My wife's the same way. I have to drag her. She gives me one a year. On Halloween, I get one a year that she'll sit and watch with me.
But yeah, that's marriage. You're right.
Yeah. So, you know, Ebola is, what's scarier than Ebola? So, I mean, I've always been drawn to it, you know, ever going way back to when I saw Outbreak, and I love rescue stories. And as you mentioned, you know, I was a paramedic, did that for 10 years. I've got a strong background in medicine. So, you know, the medicine aspect of it. So with this particular story, you have this terrifying villain, Ebola. You have really difficult, complicated medicine. And then you have this international rescue that half the world thinks is impossible and the other half of the world thinks absolutely should not happen. And when you mix all these ingredients together, it just became this incredibly exciting high-stakes story. But at its heart, you know, it's just ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And when I say ordinary, I mean like the most eccentric of ordinary people, but yeah.
We should, you know, we're making an assumption here, Kevin, that everybody knows what the Ebola virus is. A lot of people born since that time may think, oh, it's just some disease. Why don't you give us a little sense of what the impact it had on the world? And then that will make your story even more dramatic.
So in 1976, Ebola was discovered for the first time. Clearly been around for God knows how long, but that was the first time that it emerged and was identified. But it always appeared in such very remote places that it had this tendency to sort of burn through its stash of available hosts. So by the time the outside world would come into an outbreak, most of the people had been killed already. So there was not a lot of understanding of what this virus was. It would sort of pop up and then disappear and pop up and disappear. It's a hemorrhagic fever. And it's one of those things we've seen on TV. The pop culture version of it is very zombie, you know, blood coming out of the eyes. And it's madness.
I laugh, but it's madness. Yes,
it is. But the reality is, you know, essentially everything inside your skin, you know, has a tendency to want to liquefy and leak out. I mean, that's, you know, like an oversimplification, but that's, you know, hemorrhagic fevers. They take everything inside your body, all the liquid, and it pushes it out. And so, but Ebola has this tricky thing where it also causes massive clotting. So there's two terrible things happening at the same time. And it's in a very efficient killer. But we had been lucky in the sense that it always arrived in places with small populations. So a virus that has an 80% mortality rate that hits a community of 200 people, terrible for those 200 people, but it's not something the outside world ever really focuses on. What happened in 2014 that really caught everyone's attention and was quite startling was that it appeared in West Africa in not one, not two, but three different countries, all highly populated, all with capital cities of a million plus population. So it landed, you know, it was a bomb that landed in the middle of a population center, essentially, and it had a huge mortality rate. I mean, it was sometimes 70, but crept up to 90 at other times. It was, and it's the deadliest and largest Ebola outbreak in human history.
So the heart of the story is, though, that you are extracting ordinary people doing extraordinary things. You're extracting people via this small little company called Phoenix Air to the United States. So the logistics and the fear and the mechanics and the effects of all that are extraordinary in that sense. But as we talked about earlier, these are ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Yeah, you know, one of the people involved said the going wisdom at the time was you don't bring zombies into a place, you don't bring the zombie apocalypse into a place that doesn't have zombies. And that was how people saw it, was, hey, there's a virus there. Good God, don't bring that virus here. They've never
This
been
is a
on.
zombie-free zone.
Yes, we are no zombies allowed here. There was a there, you mentioned Phoenix Air. It is a small company started by two brothers in the 80s, but their founding philosophy was, if we're going to survive, we have to be willing to do things that nobody else is willing to do. And that always meant dangerous things, whether it was dangerous explosives, dangerous patients, dangerous locations. And that was how they have staked a claim in the world. And they had a piece of technology that would allow them to do this safely. The problem was nobody else knew who they were. And there was so much fear and confusion and anger around Ebola and around the idea of transporting these patients to the US. And very quickly, what started as, hey, this is a rescue mission to save two people who went overseas to help strangers, suddenly it becomes bomb threats. And it becomes politicians weighing in and saying, well, you can't do this. And it becomes entire states and entire sections of the country trying to lock down their borders to prevent this from happening. The entire world, in one way or another, was saying to these flights, you are not allowed to come here. And at the heart of it, again, is two people who are dying and one small company who's saying, we think we have an answer to save their lives if you'll just get out of our way and let us do it.
What was the technology that they had that nobody else seemed to have?
So they had this thing called an ABCS, which was an aeromedical biocontainment unit, a very fancy word for a negative pressure tent that could fit inside of a small aircraft. So imagine, if you go into some, in the movies, there'd be some government secret lab where you have to walk through airlocks and everybody's in these crazy looking spacesuits. And that's where, the most dangerous viruses are. You have to take that technology and squeeze it way down into something that will fit into a small private aircraft and will land in, on a little runway in the middle of nowhere. They developed it in the mid-2000s at the behest of the CDC, who, routinely sends their experts around the world to fight various outbreaks of disease. And the CDC's policy was for their people. So if we send you out to SARS or swine flu or bird flu, and you're in India or China or Central Africa, and you get whatever it is that we've sent you to fight, you're going to stay there until you're either better or dead.
Oh,
So,
okay.
I mean, that's a hard pill to swallow. And their experts began to say, are we sure we want to keep doing this? I would kind of prefer to die at home. Can't you find a, I mean, that's the hard calculus of relief work, is at some point you have to take into account that you might not make it out. And so the question is, if I'm going to die, do I want to die in a strange land? And the answer for most people to that question is no. And so the CDC needed a way to get them home. So they reached out to Phoenix Air, who again had established a reputation as being sort of people who could get strange things done. And they said, yeah, let's figure this out. And so the engineers and the doctors and the pilots at Phoenix Air got together and they created a small tent that could, it had filters on either side. And it was, small enough to fit within an aircraft, but large enough to fit a patient, a care provider, and whatever equipment was necessary. It had the, they created these filters so that any air, smallpox, SARS, any airborne virus that was in that tent could not escape the tent. And so they created this, but nobody else had it. I mean, to this day, their technology has not been recreated or deployed by other people.
Interesting. So I since there were two people, I assume they had to make two trips.
Yeah, they had to. Then that was so, Ebola kills on a very short timeline. from when you begin to have symptoms until you are either cured or dead is somewhere around 10 days. So by the time these people realize what they have, by the time they begin, they're because they were one was a doctor and one was a medical worker. They were working at, excuse me, a hospital. Jeez, pollen will get you. They were working at a hospital in Liberia, Monrovia, and they got sick. They were treating Ebola patients, and they both got sick. So their coworkers and the organization that sent them out there, Samaritan's Purse, was trying to find a way to get them home. So by the time Samaritan's Purse sort of was connected with Phoenix Air, several days had passed. So when this phone call comes in, it is, hey, these people only have a few days to live. You've got to get there. One, are you willing to do it? Two, are you able to do it? And then three, how are you going to do it? And as you mentioned, they were going to have to be two flights. So this was not something that they could deliberate on. As soon as the request came in, they had to make a decision about whether or not they were willing to do that.
And they already had at this point the technology developed, correct?
But they never used it. Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's one
But they
thing to
had
have
right.
it. It's
Right. I
another
was
thing
wondering.
entirely to
Yeah.
know it's going to work.
Well, aside from the technology, I'm assuming Phoenix Air doesn't necessarily have the biggest plane in the world. So how do you get that plane from Phoenix to Africa?
So you're right. It's a Gulfstream 3, which I mean I've been in. It looks planes look big from the outside. You step inside of it and you realize, oh my gosh, this is really small. But so they flew from Atlanta to there's a set of islands just off the coast of Africa. So they fly about 9 hours to these islands. They refuel and then from there they fly into Monrovia, and then obviously they refuel there when they get there. But the tricky thing and really horrible thing, if you think about this, the FAA mandates downtime for pilots.
Right.
So you can only fly so many hours before you have to take 12 hours of rest. Well, for these guys, what that meant was they had to fly into the one place on planet Earth that nobody wanted to be and stay there for 14 hours. So they had to go to a, they land at an airport that is completely abandoned. They drive through a city that is completely abandoned. There's nothing around them but smoke from fires where the city is burning bodies because they can't bury them fast enough. And they have to go to a hotel, which is all but empty. And they have to sit in this hotel. It's a beachfront hotel with tiki huts. And they're sitting in these tiki huts
Amazing.
while the world is ending around them and they're stuck there. They have no choice. They have to stay for 14 hours.
Are there no waivers available in those kinds of situations because of the emergency nature of it?
FAA does not budge.
Wow. That's a.
Yeah.
I was thinking as you were telling the story, it's a fascinating book. And as you recount it, it's a fascinating story. I keep going back to, you know, how you go and take your wife one day a year to go see. A scary picture.
Right.
I was thinking as you're telling the story that you're the one that volunteered to take the two people from Africa and put them in your home. You have to talk to your wife about that and deal with that thing. That it just came to me that way. Maybe the pollen, but okay. So they bring them back. But I mean, I would imagine, as you say, they're dealing with panic. They're dealing with politicians, which is always the same thing. They're dealing with rules and regulations. They're dealing with technology which hadn't been tried before. You got the pilots willing to take that chance. Yeah, I could see this being a major motion picture. I mean, it's just scary as all can be. Were the pilots aware that the technology hadn't been used before, but they were just willing to try it for this trip?
Oh
Two.
yeah, everybody involved, the doctors, the nurses, the pilots, they all work, they all work for Phoenix Air. And so they knew that, this is one of those places you go to because you want to do strange things in weird places. That's basically the job application. Are you willing to go somewhere that most people avoid? So they all kind of, they to a degree, they signed on for memorable and strange and weird and dangerous, but this was memorable and strange and weird and dangerous to a level that none of them had ever really experienced before. They were aware, many of them, the doctors and the engineers had been involved in the development of this thing that they were going to be using. But again, as one of the doctors involved said, it's one thing to say it, but it's another thing to crawl inside of a tent for a 14-hour transatlantic flight with the scariest virus on earth. Talk about putting your money where your mouth is. And so they knew that the technology existed. I think they trusted their process. But they were very aware that there were a lot of things they did not know. In 2014, the world knew very little about Ebola. None of these guys had ever worked around Ebola. So they, whatever their general understanding was, they knew less. So, they were well aware of what they didn't know.
You mentioned that there were two flights because I, well, you mentioned because I asked about it, that there were two separate flights. Was it the same plane going back again, or was it two separate planes, two separate sets of pilots?
It was the same plane going back again. There was a second plane that was outfitted, but they wanted to save that for an emergency, just in case something went wrong. Because when these two Americans first get diagnosed, their first effort was, well, let's bring them to Europe. The WHO and all these, MSF, Doctors Without Borders is a huge organization. They were the other group that was there fighting Ebola. So the thought was, well, maybe we get them to Switzerland, maybe we can get them to France, where there's some people who are used to fighting this and perhaps they've got an idea. Problem was, none of those countries were willing to take an Ebola patient. And then the countries that they would have to fly over were refusing these planes into their airspace. Because if I let you into my airspace, somewhere in that agreement is the idea that if something goes wrong in your plane, you're going to land. And nobody wants the zombie plane landing. Nobody in Cairo wants a zombie plane landing in the middle of their city.
Right. I mean, it's
So
laughable, but it's serious at the same time. Is it?
it is.
Yeah.
We can't. What do you do? You gotta laugh to a certain degree because it's so extraordinary. So they knew that there was zero margin for error. So they wanted to keep a plane in reserve, knowing that if something were to go wrong and they needed help, that there was really only this one thing left over. And anytime you bring a plane back, it needs a certain amount of service. Like there are things that happen. So if you sent them simultaneously and something went wrong, that other plane is down and then you're in real trouble.
Yeah, you've got to clean out the plane. You've got to get rid of the peanut bags and the sodas that you served and all
Tons of sodas, so many
that
sodas.
stuff. Yeah. How did you gather the information for this story? In other words, you obviously had access to various entities and people, including, I'm sure, Phoenix Air. Was it because of your background that they trusted you? You had written several books before, and they knew your background as a paramedic, etc. Was that enough to grant you access? I don't know if the word is grant you access, but talk to you and give you interviews, give you background materials, etc.
Yeah, people there had read the books and were able to vouch for me. And there was a degree of trust that was there. One of the company started by two brothers, Mark and Dent Thompson. And Dent had read two of my books before. So he was aware of sort of how I write and what I do and that I understood the medicine, which to him was the important part. He didn't want someone to come in, sort of butcher the story and not represent it well. And he thought that I would be able to do that. But then, once you start, that's one angle, Once you start digging into a story, you realize, oh, they're over here is this other person doing their thing. And then there's a doctor in Africa who's treating people and what's going on with her. And then at some point you say, okay, well, these people have to come to a hospital. Who were those doctors? And how did they get put in that position? So, you begin to build out this world, but it does help when you're not brand new, when you have something you can point to and say, like, hey, I've done this before. I promise you'll be in good hands.
Were you able to get access to government agencies or officials that provided you material, knowing that you were working on the book?
I spoke with some State Department officials, some customs officials, various government agencies. There were certain documents that I was able to get a hold of. There's some things that are public record that I was able to look at in terms of testing data and just various things that were going on. But then there's also not everybody necessarily wants to talk. The state of Maine was particularly agitated about this because they were the original point of entry. I didn't really have much success with the state of Maine. Officials in Maine threatened at one point to press felony charges against a member of the State Department. So they were really, really against this. And sometimes in hindsight, people kind of don't necessarily want to poke their head up out of the hole.
I was going to ask you, there are so many heroes to the story, and I was going to say, who were there any villains? You mentioned the state of Maine as a potential villain in that. Were there others as well? Were there obstinate government agencies or even private organizations that kind of blocked the way for initially and then finally got out of the way?
Oh, absolutely. I would say most of the government agencies weren't necessarily villains, but they were concerned. Bureaucrat is a word that we throw around very lightly and often very derisively, but these are career experts in various fields who take their jobs very seriously. And they know when things go right, politicians take the credit. But when things go wrong, the politicians will say, well, that was the department of whatever. If you head up the Department of Homeland Security and they do something well, the head of the Department of Homeland Security is going to take credit for that. But when something goes wrong, he'll say, oh, that was this branch or this branch or, those bureaucrats. So the people at these agencies, whether it's the TSA or customs, with tons and tons of state agencies, all the port authorities, all these different things that we're going to have to be contact, airport authorities, all these people knew, hey, if this we allow this to come in and something goes wrong and people get sick, everybody's going to point the finger at us. So they wanted to make sure that their regulations were being serviced. The problem was this had to happen so fast that there really was no time for these regulations to be serviced. So a lot of what's happening as the plane is both taking off and returning, because as the plane is landing, they don't have a place to land. And there's actually a customs agent in Miami, or excuse me, in Maine, who's on the phone with a superior saying, we've got to let them land. Otherwise, they fly until they run out of fuel. And then you have a plane with an Ebola patient crashing into the American heartland. Is that what you want? So a lot of it was the recognition that if something goes wrong, we're going to get the blame. So let's make sure at least that we've done things by the book. But there was no, so a lot of effort had to go into like pushing that out of the way. But, there were a lot of private citizens, ordinary people who were really against it and protested. There were bomb threats that were made. There were politicians who, there were, like somebody said at one point, don't do this because if you allow it, what's going to happen is someone's going to treat Ebola. So let's just say a doctor is treating an Ebola patient and he's going to wash his hands. And Ebola tainted fluids are going to go down the drain, and that's going to go to the sewers, and that's going to go to the rats, and the rats are going to get Ebola, and then they're going to come out, and you're going to have an Ebola outbreak carried by the rats all through the city of Atlanta. I mean, this is a level of hysteria that was going on. The
That's a film.
hospital.
That's a film you should take your wife to see.
I know. Look, I would go see that one. Ebola rats coming out of the sewer. I'm in.
Wow.
But, Emory University Hospital was ringed by protesters. They had bomb threats. They had to establish a second post office because they were getting so many suspicious packages. People were really against this. They were really, really against this.
In your book, it's called No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to, and There's Nowhere Else to Turn. You use the term rogue heroes. It implies that they were not complying with any regulations or rules, but it sounds like they actually went to these various authorities and worked with the government to make this happen.
Yeah, to a degree, they did their best to say, hey, this is what we're going to do. But they reached a moment in these meetings where they essentially had to say, guys, this is happening. The president has approved it. Even though the government's not involved, the president has said it's okay. So they're dying. The clock is ticking. You're going to have to just get out of our way. But as I was saying before, they've established themselves since the early 80s as an organization that will do some crazy stuff. And a lot of what has to happen, oftentimes are things that are sort of unorthodox. Even if you're not breaking the rules, if you're in compliance, there, I guess
They're
there's bending, there's stretching, and there's breaking.
I think the word is fudging.
Yes, a lot of fudging.
Before I let you go, what do you want readers to take from the book? It's a fascinating story. But what would you want readers to take from reading your book? Is it more than one message? There's several messages, I think, from reading it, but I'll let you tell us.
I would say first, the quickest and easiest one is this was only done through preparation. That there was an organization that had the technology, that there were people that were trained, that there was a hospital that had a unit that could handle it and had doctors and nurses that were properly trained. Public health is so important. And you look at what happened, in Atlanta, the multiple patients, dozens of patients come in, treated successfully. Two patients went to Dallas where there was no preparation. Excuse me, one patient went to Dallas where there's no preparation. That patient died and two nurses got sick. So the difference between a robust public health infrastructure, which is there for all of us, and one that we devalue is massive and puts us at risk. The other I would say is, we live in kind of divided times, and there's often, questions about, where are the heroes, or what are the principles that we're willing to risk ourselves for? These were people who believed in what they were doing. And before they were asked to do it, they told themselves, if the moment ever comes, I will. And then the moment came and I had to do it. And they had to decide, do I really, am I going to stand on those principles? Am I going to put myself at risk for strangers? And the answer for them was yes. And as you mentioned in the beginning, these are ordinary people. There's nothing overly heroic about them as people, but their actions incredibly heroic. And I think that's something that we can all take away. These are simply ordinary people who did the right thing simply because it was the right thing to do. And I find a tremendous amount of inspiration in that. And if we can expect that and get it from doctors and from nurses and from pilots, then we can get it from the rest of us. That is in all of us. It's just a question of if we're willing to stand up for those principles that we claim to believe in.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Kevin Hazard. He's author of No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to When There's Nowhere Else to Turn. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. It's available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Kevin, go to kevinhazard.com, and you can follow him on Facebook and Instagram. And Kevin, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much. Enjoy it, Ira.
Thanks. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.